Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture by 2006 Nobel Peace Prize laureate Dr. Mohamed Yunus. Dr. Yunus is founder of the Grameen Bank, which provides credit to the poor in rural Bangladesh without any collateral. His lecture is titled, Because Poverty is the Absence of Every Human Right. Introducing Dr. Yunus is Boston University President Robert Brown.
Welcome to this wonderful occasion, and a special welcome to Dr. Mohamed Yunus to Boston University. As we all know, Dr. Yunus was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006, and it's a great occasion to have him visit us, but I'd like to make sure the audience understands that there's a great connection between the Nobel Peace Prize and Boston University. We have three distinguished people connected with this university that have won this award. Martin Luther King Jr., who studied here and is a distinguished alumnus of the School of Theology. Elie Wiesel, who's on the faculty at Boston University. And just recently, Al Gore, who had the good fortune and wisdom to marry Tippi Gore, who's an alum of Boston University. Three connections of the prize. Dr. Yunus is an inspiration to us all. As you will hear, after receiving his doctorate in economics in the United States, he returned to his native Bangladesh to teach economics. Instead of teaching it, he lived it. He became a banker on a revolutionarily small scale. Now, we all live in a scientific age where we hear the words nanoscience and nanotechnology all the time. But there are few inventions that are being considered by these scientists and engineers that will have a larger impact on our lives, and I dare say the same is true for most large bankers, than the dream that Dr. Yunus began. He is still a teacher. He teaches us by example and by deed. He teaches us about hope, opportunity, and fulfillment. We are grateful that you can be with us today, sir, and to share with your lessons with us. On behalf of our colleagues, our students, and our friends who are able to be with us today, I am very pleased to welcome you to Boston University.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. If you are in Bangladesh, no matter when, today or 10 years back or 20 years back, 50 years back, this is one country where it's very easy to get frustrated. Things don't seem to work. And that's the frustration which drives people, drives particularly young people, to seek new ways of addressing the issues. And I was teaching in one of the universities in the States, Middle Tennessee State University, near Nashville. And Bangladesh ran into, at that time it was known as East Pakistan, a part of Pakistan. Pakistan had two parts, East Pakistan and West Pakistan, divided by India in between, about 1,000 miles apart. So we got into a big war between the two parts of the country. And one side was the government and the military attacking the civilians of the other side. And instantaneously, East Pakistan declared its own independence, that we don't want to live with Pakistan anymore, we want to be a separate country. And young people around the world coming from East Pakistan, we declared our allegiance to new country, Bangladesh. So we went through the whole 1 year of 9 months of war, lot of devastations, lot of killings. At the end of 1971, Bangladesh became an independent country. So as soon as we became an independent country, I resigned from my job. I said, this is the time to go back and be part of the efforts in building the country. So that's when I went back. And I joined Chittagong University, one of the universities in Bangladesh, and start my job in this university as a teacher of economics. And each liberation war, something you get a tremendous amount of emotionally charged that you want to create a new country, you want to build a new future for your nation. And after you achieve that, you go through the euphoria that now is the time to build it in the images of your dreams. But in most cases, those dreams turn into nightmares. They don't work out. Things seem to go wrong rather than go right. And that's exactly happened in our case in Bangladesh. Things started going wrong. Economy was sliding down very fast. And the country was in total sham, total devastated condition. So by 1974, we had a terrible famine. People dying of hunger. We are familiar with people dying of diseases. But seeing people dying of hunger, it's a completely different experience. It's not a disease. It's not something that you can reach for medicine, you reach for medical help. It's nothing like that. Just dying because there's just not tiny little bit to eat. And that made it more kind of painful because you are teaching elegant theories in your economics class. So here you teach those beautiful, absolutely sophisticated theories and telling your students how economics can address all these problems. Then at the end of the class, you walk out of the classroom, you see the stark reality of the country, people dying of hunger. Your economics theory doesn't come into any use for them. So you wonder what good it is in the face of the situation that you confront. So gradually, a feeling of emptiness seizes you. That you see that all those brilliant theories don't come to use when it comes to situation like what prevails around you. So out of that frustration, one of the things that I thought I could do, instead of trying to be an economist, I could just try to be a simple human being, which I can always revert to, and be with the people and see as a human being what I can do. Not as an economist, because this is not going to work for me. And the university that I was teaching is right in the middle of the villages. So it's not an urban center, urban-based university campus, like in most of the cases that you see. So we had a lot of controversy about it, whether we should build the university right in the middle of the villages. But this time, for me, came out very handy. I could just walk out of the classroom, walk out of the borderline of the campus and be in the traditional village, centuries-old village next door. So I thought that's what I'll do. Every day I'll go around and meet people there, see if there's anything that I can do for one single person to make it easy for that person even to live a little better for this one day. I don't have the capacity to make a permanent contribution in any way, but definitely I have the capacity to help one person for one day. So with that kind of idea that I was going around and finding things to do every day, and I did a lot of little things, and I feel a little bit at ease because watching it happen and the feeling that you are totally useless is a terrible feeling. And now I could at least feel that I'm trying to do something, and in some cases I'm doing something. And as I was doing and feeling a little better, I gradually get acquainted with something else, which I never figured before. How moneylenders in that village kind of grab poor people and totally destroy their life for tiny little money. Accidentally, I got into that picture. And I was shocked by the first instance that I saw. And I was curious. I wanted to know how does it go about and how much desperate people must be to go to the moneylender, to get into that kind of contractual obligations. So what I did, I took a student of mine from my class and went around in the village for the next few days to make a list of people who borrowed from the moneylenders. In a few days, I made the list complete, and it had 42 names on my list. And the total money they borrowed was $27. And I couldn't believe, because I never heard anything about $27. I'm trained to think in terms of millions of dollars and billions of dollars. We, in the classroom, we talk about the national development plans, five-year plans, if you remember those days. We used to be big in five-year plans. So we talk about the five-year plans and how investments have to be made in the country so that gradually economy picks up and poor people improve their life and things go better. But here I see completely different picture. Only a few yards from the classroom where I teach. It's not on the other side of the moon. It's right there. So I was amazed that these person like us teaching those economic theories or economic discussions that we have in our classrooms have absolutely no idea what goes on in the village next doors. And there's no solution to that in our discussion. So after I overcome my shock, I can see that how terrible that problem is. But suddenly it occurred in my mind, the problem is tough. Problem is very difficult. But the solution is so simple. And it excited me by the simpleness of the solution. It just hit me, instead of worrying about the whole problem, I can just take $27 out of my own pocket and give the money to these 42 people to return the money to the moneylenders. And they will be free. Moneylenders cannot touch them anymore. I was very excited. And I did exactly that. I gave this $27 to all these 42 people, person by person, telling them that here is the money, you return the money and you continue what you're doing. And you can think about paying me back when you are comfortable, when it's easy for you. Don't worry about it. And I thought, this is something I did. I feel good about it. At least I solved one problem in a very concrete way. But something else happened, which I didn't expect. When I go back to the village again, talking to people, now people look at me in a very different way. They look at me in a very strange way, as if I have descended from the heaven. I said, my God, for $27, if you can become an angel, why shouldn't you do more of this? You still can afford to give some more money. And if it's so important for their life, you should do it. So that kind of new question haunted me. How do I do more? I could still give some money from my pocket. And I was thinking, no, that maybe not be the solution, because it has to go on in its own way. Again, another brilliant idea came to my mind. Why don't I link these people to the bank which is located in the campus? And bank should be very happy, because after all, this is a tiny little money for the bank to give it to the people, and they become the hero, and everybody will appreciate what they're doing. So I thought it's a win-win situation from both sides. And I become the matchmaker for them. So with the kind of this brilliant thought in my mind, I go to talk to the manager of the bank, and I propose to him that this is your opportunity. You lend the money to the poor people in the village. He almost fell from the sky. He couldn't believe that I have such an audacious plan for him. He said, no, it cannot be done. Bank cannot lend money to the poor people. And the more he insists, the more I raise question. Why shouldn't bank give it? What is the problem with the bank? And only explanation he could give, bank cannot give loans to the poor people because they are not creditworthy. I said, how do you know that? Have you ever given loans to the poor people? He said, no, I have not done that. So how do you know? I said, everybody knows that. Poor people cannot pay back because their stomach is empty. If you give the money, they will just eat and forget about it. I said, is it that simple? Then why should the moneylenders lend money to them? They know it too. Anyway, I couldn't persuade him. He couldn't persuade me. So we were in a big, we locked into a big fight. So that fight went to the higher officials in the banking hierarchy, went to talk to the senior officials in the banking world. Everybody tells me the same thing. It went on for months and no solution. Finally, I came up with another idea. This time I learned from their language and I used their language. I said, why don't you accept me as a guarantor? I sign all your papers, I take the risk, and you give the money. All I want to open your door. And that's important for me. So this time, since I speak their language, they couldn't really throw me out of the window. So they had to continue this dialogue, and finally, I think, to get rid of me, they agreed. So at least they thought this will end the whole story, and I'll learn in a hard way that it doesn't work. So they agreed, and I was very happy that finally I won the case, and I can go ahead and take the money. And that's exactly what I did. I took the money from the bank and started giving the money to the people in the village. And the bank manager on the first day said, Dr. Yunus, say goodbye to your money. This money will never come back. And get ready to pay back the money. I said, I have no idea. I have never done this. I thought this is the right thing to do, and I'm doing it. I'll find a way, and I'm sure people will pay back. But if not, I'll find a way how to do it right. So I came up with tiny little ideas to try so that people find it easy to pay back. And it worked. Every penny came back. So I got very excited that what I never imagined that it will happen that way, although I was hoping that it will work. Now this time it's real. It worked. So with that enthusiasm, I kept on expanding this. The more I become successful, the more bank becomes reluctant. Because he was hoping that the first time it will be such a disaster that I will not pursue this anymore. But it was not a disaster. So he was hoping second time it will be a disaster. It was not a disaster. So every time it becomes successful, he feels very disappointed. So seeing his reluctance, I thought that may be not the right thing to do. In the beginning, I had no idea whether this is going to work or not. I had a belief. That's the only thing I had. And now it's not a belief. It's a demonstrated facts. I said, if anybody in the world tells me now that poor are not creditworthy, I'll go and scream my head off telling that this is a lie. This is not true. Because I see it every day. People are paying back 100%. How can they not be creditworthy? Where in Bangladesh, rich people borrow from big banks and don't care to pay back. In Bangladesh, banks are filled with big loan defaulters. And here the poor people taking tiny loans and paying back. So I thought maybe I should create a separate bank. Bank which will do exclusively business with the poor people. I needed a license. I needed a permission from the government. So I went to the government. Another struggle began to persuade the government. Because government has a crazy idea. How can you have a bank for the poor people? And they started arguing with me, we have enough of problem running banks for the rich people because they don't pay back. Now why do you want to create more problem by creating another bank for the poor people? And I kept saying, look, this experience will be much different than the experience that you have because here are your records. Anyway, it continued for 2 years, and I was very lucky. Finally, I got through the kind of labyrinth of government and finally got my proposal approved, and we got ourselves a bank, and we created this bank called Grameen Bank. Grameen means village, so we wanted to call it a village bank. So that became a village bank. So we kept on expanding and expanding. And today, right now, we have 7.5 million borrowers in Grameen Bank in Bangladesh. 97% of them are women. And the bank gives tiny loans to the poor people for income-generating activity. And they take the loan and start self-employment and improve their economic situation and move up the poverty situation. 64% of the borrowers of Grameen Bank who have been with Grameen Bank for more than 5 years have already crossed over the poverty line. So it's not a simple just giving loans. It's a step-by-step people are moving out of poverty. Every day, every week, every month, more and more families are moving out. And we have been concentrating on one particular area now, the children of Grameen families. The Grameen families are basically illiterate families, cannot read, cannot write. These are women who never held money in their hand, no experience whatsoever. For the first time, touching money is an exciting feeling for them, for it. In many occasions, when you will be lending money in the beginning, when you give this tiny loan, as small as $30, $35 loan, women will be holding this loan and literally shake, couldn't believe that so much money is in her hand. And tears will roll down, cannot believe anybody has trusted her such an enormous amount of money. And she feels that nobody believed her, nobody trusted her for a penny. Now this bank comes and gives her so much money. And in her mind, she runs through her experience. And then she resolves that if anybody has trusted her with so much money, she would like to give her life to protect that trust so that that trust is never broken. And exactly she does that. She works very hard to make sure every penny gets paid back on the dot, never delayed. So if you can kind of multiply this experience 7.5 million times, you can understand what Grameen Bank is. That's where we are. So one of the things we are trying to encourage them is to send their children to school, because we thought this is one way to make a change in the family. Because education or literacy never entered this family in the history of generations. So at least this will be a new beginning. And they understood the importance of education, so they joined with us and make sure the children are in school. So very quickly we achieved that goal, 100% children of Grameen families being in school. Then we saw that many of these children not only went to school, they are at the top of the classes. That excited us, that for the first time, coming from the poorest families, illiterate families, going into school and being on the top of the class. We got so excited, we thought this needs to be celebrated. Somehow we have to recognize this. So one way we thought we can do that, we introduced scholarships. So anybody who has the top performers in the family, we give the child a scholarship. Right now, we give more than 30,000 scholarships throughout Grameen Bank. It's a standard annual feature. We celebrate, we kind of give them flowers, and the whole village comes together. He got a scholarship. And every other child gets excited. What did he do? What did she do? So that way, that encourages other students to follow the suit. Then later, we found something else. Not only they went to school, and some of them coming to the top of the class. Now this time we see some of them are in higher education. They're in medical schools, engineering schools, in universities. That was a very pleasant surprise for us because we didn't expect that this flow to go all the way there. Then we again sat down and discussed what do we do now. So one thing we came up with is introduced education loan. So ever since we are giving education loans, because when you enter the higher level, it becomes expensive. Most of the families cannot afford to keep the students at that level. So they drop out and quit education and do something else, start vending things or little shops and something. So we said, no way. If you are capable, if you want to go into higher education, entire financing will be done by Grameen Bank. So we do that. Right now, we have over 18,000 students in medical schools, engineering schools, universities. And it amazes us to see that. It's a completely different group of people coming there. You meet them, you see there's no difference between these kids or the kids in any university anywhere in the world. But they're coming from the poorest families for the first time, first-generation people going into universities and medical schools and so on. Two of them already finished their PhDs. We celebrated that. They finished their PhDs. And many doctors are now practicing, some of them now university teachers in many different departments. So this is a new generation coming from this generation which entered the first time the Grameen Bank. So our idea is the cycle of poverty which continues within their family should be broken. So with these children coming up as a new generation, they will create a new wave rather than join the same old cycle, repetitive cycle that went on for generations and generations. Another aspect that we introduced recently, I think, would be very interesting for you. There are lots of debates. Microcredit, the kind of work that we do, became very well known throughout the world. Many people want to do that. So it created a lot of controversies. Criticism that sometimes it's brought out in the discussions on the table, then microcredit is a wonderful idea, but it works only for entrepreneurial poor, poor who has the capacity to go into business and so on. But most of them are not entrepreneurs. So for them, it won't work. Particularly, poorest of the poor don't have the entrepreneurial capacity. They should be left alone with the safety net programs, meaning handouts, charity program, welfare programs, and that sort of programs. And I always oppose those kind of things by saying that, and this became my conviction, and I continue to maintain that conviction. My conviction is all human beings are entrepreneurs, no exception. So it's built into the human life. A child is born with that entrepreneurial capacity. It's a human dimension built into it. But we have created a society where many people never discovered the talent that they have inside of them. So for them, they feel maybe I'm not an entrepreneur. All I can do is work for somebody else. It's not really true that he or she doesn't have it. Simply, that person never had the opportunity to unwrap the gift she has inside of her. Society never encouraged it, never allowed it to have a peep into that wonderful gift he or she carries. So I think that's the failure of the society, not the failure of the person. And I give the example of a bonsai tree. I said, if you take the best seed of the tallest tree in the forest and plant it in a little flower pot and let it grow, it grows only this big. Then you wonder, what happened to it? We poured our heart out to make it grow, but it doesn't grow. It just becomes this big and looks exactly like the tree that we saw in the forest, but only it's a tiny, tiny one. And I keep saying the poor people are the bonsai people. There's nothing wrong with their seeds. Simply society never gave them the space or never gave them the base on which to grow. If you had the base for them as wide as anybody else, they will grow as tall as anybody else. No fault of the person. So the poverty is not created by the poor people. Sometimes we kind of jump into conclusions, it's their fault. they don't work hard, or they're stupid, they don't have the training, they don't have the skill. We get a whole list out of it. But that's not true. They work very hard. It's the poor who work the hardest, but get the least. That's why they are poor. So it's not the fault of the poor. Then whose fault is it? Who created poverty? And I keep saying that the poverty is created by the system that we built for us. And the system is made up of the institutions that we built, this theoretical framework that we created, concepts that we built. So they are at fault. If we had some mechanism to go back to those concepts and theories and the institutions and pick out all the seeds of poverty inside of them, take them out, there'll be nobody poor. Because poverty is not created. The system is now free from poverty, so people are free from poverty. And I give the example of one institution, the institution of banking. Why do they have to say that some people are not creditworthy? Is it their prerogative to make judgment on people? Or people should make judgment on them? Shouldn't we kind of rephrase that question by saying, by redesigning the question, by raising it this way? Are the banks people worthy? Isn't that the legitimate question? And the answer is no, they are not. Because if you look around, 2/3 of the world population are not eligible in the eyes of the banks to do business with them. So what kind of institution is it which doesn't give you the permission to do business? Who are they to judge that whether I can do business or not? If I cannot do business with a bank, then it is the responsibility of the bank to redesign itself so that I can do business with them. It's not my responsibility to redesign myself so that I can do business with them. So that point is missed. As a result, people are refused, rejected from the banking services. So if you don't have that access to financial services, you are thrown into the wolves, the moneylenders, loan sharks, which sucks up everything that you got. And that's what happens every day. We read about it in the newspaper. We read about it in stories, in plays, in literature. Pound of flesh. Remember that. Shakespeare. It's all there. But nobody did anything to help them because it's not us, it's them. So who cares about them? We are okay. We got the bank account. We got our credit cards. No problem. So this is the problem. So today, something that we built worked for the poor people? Is it something that we lend money, tiny little money to the poor people? Is that what makes Grameen Bank? That's all? Or there is something else? If, say, Citibank started giving tiny loans, $30 loans or $50 loans in Bangladesh, will it become a microcredit bank or a Grameen Bank? No. It's not just size of the loan. It's the way you do business. That's what makes it microcredit. In our business, in our work, there is no collateral. First thing, we removed. No collateral. Because if you're asking for collateral to the poor people, they will never get to you because they have nothing to offer. So that is thrown away, thrown out of the window. No guarantee. You don't need anybody's guarantee. No legal instrument, no papers to be signed which can be taken to the court. We don't go to the court. We said, forget it. For this little money, if you're going to the court, it will be stupid. You'll be spending a lot of money to the lawyers, giving to the lawyers. Why spend those money and create those problems for you? So we abandon that. So it's a collateral free, no guarantee, no legal instrument. Then how does it work? Is it trust-based banking? It's a mutual trust. And that works. not only works in Bangladesh, it now works globally, everywhere. So this is the essence of it. We give loans for income-generating activities so that they can move up, creating their own income opportunity and continue, and then help the children to go into school and everything that I said about that, and change their life completely. Our goal is to reach, I said, 64% of the borrowers have crossed the poverty line. They are no longer poor. Our goal by 2015, to make sure all the Grameen Bank borrowers get out of poverty completely, 100%. With the Millennium Development Goal, the world is trying to reach a situation where half the poverty will be overcome. Half the number of poor people get out of poverty. That's a global goal. But within Grameen Bank, we have decided we will use the same years, 2015, to make sure 100% of the borrowers of Grameen families, all the Grameen families get out of poverty. And it's an achievable goal. It's not a fantasy. It's not something that you dream, but you feel that maybe you can't achieve it. We can achieve it. And what else? I said the concept is at fault. And I talk about the concept of business, particular one that I choose to demonstrate. I said, look, the way we build the economic theory and build the theory of business and everything that we put into it, based on the assumption that all people who go into business go there to make money. That's the only reason why you go into business, to make money. And theory makes it very clear. It says profit maximization is the mission of business. That's fine. Wonderful. But are all people, everybody is doing that? Is that what they're supposed to do in business? So the theory has been built on the assumption of one-dimensional human being. Human being has only one urge, is to make money. That's all. But that's not the real people. That may be the people in the theory. But the real-world people is much bigger than that. They have many other urges. They want to touch other people's life. They want to contribute to this world. They want to feel happy in being useful to somebody else. How come we cannot accommodate it within economic theory? How do we have it just one-dimensional person rather than multi-dimensional person? All human beings are multidimensional beings, not a single-dimensional beings. It's a mixture of many things. So I said, at least to justify the real human being into the theory, we should keep at least two kinds of businesses. One kind that we already know, the kind which takes business as a money-making opportunity. The goal is to maximize profit. That's fine. Another business will be a business to do good to people. There are no intention of personally benefiting from that. All the benefits should be given to the people that we want to run the business for. And I'm designating it, calling it as a social business, and define it by saying it's a non-loss, non-dividend company. It doesn't lose money, but it doesn't give dividend to the investor. That's a social business. We created such company in Bangladesh and encouraging others to create such companies. One company drew a lot more attention than others. That's a company that we jointly did in Bangladesh with Danone. Danone is the company which produces the yogurt, all the milk products, all the water, Evian water. So we had a joint company with them. We proposed to them, why don't we create a Grameen Danone company in Bangladesh? And our idea of creating this company is to produce yogurt, but for a very special purpose. There are lots of malnourished children in Bangladesh because of poverty, because of a lack of ability of the parents to feed the children well. So the children grow up extremely malnourished. And as the child grows up malnourished, it becomes, or he or she becomes a target for all other diseases as she grows up. So idea that we have, why don't we produce yogurt, Danone yogurt, as tasty as it is, and then put all the micronutrients which is missing in those children into the yogurt. All the vitamins, zinc, iron, iodine, whatever is missing, into the yogurt and sell it to the children. Children buy the cheap snacks like ice cream or local sweets or whatever. At the same price, they get the yogurt. And the yogurt company, Grameen Danone Company, recovers all their cost by the sales proceeds, and the children get the health by eating this yogurt. This will be a great thing if they can improve the health. The mission of the business is accomplished. And the owner of the company, the Grameen or the Danone, gradually they can take over, take back their investment money, but once they have recouped the investment money, no more dividend coming from there. So don't expect any dividend to come from you, because that's not the intention why you built the company. You built the company to help the children get better health. As long as that health is done, your mission is accomplished. So this would be a social business. And another one, we recently signed an agreement with Intel Corporation, the information technology chip producer. The chairman of Intel visited us in Bangladesh, and we discussed that, and out of that discussion, this idea of creating an Intel Grameen company as a social business to bring information technology to the poorest people in a way they can change their own life, redesign the whole gadgets and the ways of handling it and bringing information on healthcare and education and everything that's possible to the children and to the families of poor people and help them change their own life. And there, Intel doesn't get any dividend out of it. Grameen doesn't get any dividend out of it, but it brings the information technology to the poorest people and runs as a business, earns enough to pay for all the expenses they incur. So these are the examples that we would like to carry on in terms of social business, in healthcare, in education, in bringing good quality drinking water to the poor people or people who don't have that access to pure drinking water. So we need to address these issues as a separate improvement into the overall structure of the economy that we have in our thinking process, the way we do that. And once we accept the idea of social business, many other steps need to be taken. One of such steps will be in the university. You have to teach another course, social business. And now we have the business school which produces MBAs. And these are the young people, like you are, many of you probably are studying to get the MBA degree. And MBAs are prepared, the young people are prepared to go out and help the profit-maximizing companies to make more profit. That's where they are getting ready to do that. So we need another department which will be teaching social MBAs to go out and make sure your company reaches out to the people that you want to reach and help them change their life in a social business way. And design social businesses. What is the problem? How do you design that? This is one of the challenge. Young people will be designing social business plans so that this works out both ways. It's a beautiful program, it helps people, it runs as a business. So that will be a wonderful thing. And once we can introduce that, it becomes very powerful, because today we can help people only through charities, through the foundation activities. And charities or foundation activities, when you use a dollar, that dollar has only one life. If you use that, it's done. It achieves the goal, but you cannot reuse this dollar. You cannot take it back again. You have done it, it's gone. But in social business, dollar keeps coming back. It continues to recycle. So you reach out to more people. And life of that dollar becomes endless, because it never disappears. So it becomes more and more powerful. So this is another area. And the other area that we have to work is in the stock market. Today, the only stock market we have where we can go and find a company where we can become rich overnight. And that's what we're always looking for, which company to choose. Where do we put our money? Because we want to make money. If I want to do good, I cannot go to the stock market because there is no such company which tells me this company will do good, this, and no profit. So we need a social stock market where all the social businesses will be listed so that if I want to help the poor women get out of poverty, I see there are 21 companies who are doing that, and I want to choose the best, where they are doing most effectively, most dedicatedly committed people and getting good results, so I want to put my money there so that I can help more people coming out of poverty, more women coming out of poverty, and so on, more children out of the street. That's if this company doing it, I would like to put my money in. So we have a series of parallel kind of institutional arrangements that we have to build. Then we have a world where we can now reach out to all the problems ourselves instead of dumping all the problems on the shoulder of the government. Today, if we see a problem, it's that government should do it. We citizens are as powerful, sometimes more powerful than the government, because we are more innovative than the government. We are quick in action. Government takes a lot of time before they can make a decision. And then it gets stuck with the bureaucracy and so on. But we are free as individual citizens. We can build our things and address maybe a little corner of the world, maybe a little corner of our country, but we have demonstrated it. Once we have demonstrated it, then it can be replicated by anybody. It becomes very powerful. Like we replicate microcredit, for example. Now that microcredit idea has spread all over the world. In some countries, people invite us to help them set up microcredit program because they have lots of questions, lot of worries whether it will work in their country or not. And we tell them, why don't you give us a challenge? We come and set it up for you. And we are calling that build, operate, transfer, or build, operate, and own kind of contract. You give us the contract, we come and do it for you. And many countries have invited us, and we are doing that. We have done it in Myanmar. We have done it in Kosovo. We are doing it in Turkey, in Zambia, in Tanzania, in Costa Rica, in Guatemala, in India, so in China. So there's a lot of countries where we are invited to do this. And now recently we invited ourselves, nobody invited us as such, to do it in Queens, in New York. So same way we build, operate, and build up a Grameen program within USA, right here in New York City, in Queens. We're starting out with the Queens. So I was telling them the Queens that the Queens is a Jobra of USA. Jobra was the first village where we worked when I was in the university. So now Queens becomes our Jobra, where we start building it up. Because this has an interesting challenge here. Because this is a country with such a sophisticated banking, but at the same time you see pawn shops everywhere. This doesn't sound right. If you have a decent banking system, why there should be pawn shops? And check cashing companies. Would you believe that? You have your own check. You earned the money. You can't get the equivalent of the money that is in the check. You have to give 20% to the guy who gives you in cash. What happened to the banking system? No, banking system is not available to them because they cannot open an account. Would you believe people cannot open an account in their bank? In the bank? They are rejected because too small amount. We are not interested in that amount. So they're forced to go to these people who charge enormous amount of money just every month, not just once. Every month you get your check, you get to the check cashing counters and get 20% less of what you earned. You earned your hard way, but somebody takes away your money. That's what the challenge, that's what we want to address through what we call Grameen America, to bring all this together and we are launching it there to see how to address those issues. It's unbelievable that it can happen. And also, at the same time, you see the payday loans. you need a little money in the middle of the month. You don't have the money to fix your tire or something, you fix your car. So you go to the payday loans. You pay as much as 40%, 50% interest on those loans. Nobody cares. So these are the issues for social business. These are the issues for addressing. That's why we're trying to just develop a prototype. We'd be very happy if you can associate yourself into that kind of program to see how to bring ideas, to bring it into a kind of banking framework rather than predatory activity of moneylenders and so on and so forth. Poverty is not part of human being. It's artificially imposed on human being. We can peel it off. And if we can peel it off, there'll be no poor person. And I keep saying, all we have to aim is to create poverty museums. Set a date. On that date, we are going to have a poverty museum because we will not have any more poor people left in our country or left in our city or left in our district, whatever. Then we'll have our poverty museums so that next generation children read about poverty but wouldn't know what poverty is. So we will take them, the whole class, to the museum to show what poverty used to be like. And that's the decision we have to make. That's the kind of pledge we have to create. By this date, we would create our poverty museum. In Bangladesh, we kind of repeat saying that by 2030, we'll have our poverty museum. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
This is WBUR. You've been listening to a lecture titled Because Poverty is the Absence of Every Human Right by 2006 Nobel Peace Prize laureate Dr. Mohamed Yunus. Introducing Dr. Yunus was Boston University President Robert Brown. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Michael Garth and Mike Toda with help from Rachel Paste and Ian Kennedy. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.